And with that, we'll introduce Dr. Michelle Friedman, who has also wonderfully combines the disciplines of mental health and Jewish law. She serves as the Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University. She has a private practice, and she is the head of the Pastoral Counseling Program at Chovevei Torah. So she is in the forefront of training, you know, rabbis, and in the forefront of working with people in our community in areas of psychiatry and the interface of mental health and Jewish life and religion. It is a pleasure to introduce you.
First, I want to thank Rabbi Kelman and for bringing us here and for providing this wonderful opportunity. I also want to thank Rabbi Dr. Weiss for setting up really what was a beautiful crystalline outline, which I think I'll take the liberty of saying, I think that Rabbi Dr. Weinrib and myself, and we are going to kind of discuss some of these principles in kind of more clinical terms, where we can talk about and see the play out of some of these principles and ideas in the on the ground experience. So just a few words on where I'm coming from and how I want to do this. I think we're going to be the low-tech group here because none of us are really PowerPoint-oriented. So my speaking notes are on page 61 if you want to look at that. I think at the original time of the email discussions of this topic, you'll see my number 3 was talking about impact of childhood abuse as well, which didn't make it onto the updated draft. So if we don't get there, we don't. If we do, we do. You know, I kind of leave it up to you. But in terms of how I'd like to do this in my time, I very much would like to hear your thoughts. Really, even during my talking, I kind of see this more as a conversation. I thought of this group as, as a lot of medical professionals, and probably a lot of Jewish educators, and people who are involved in Jewish communal life. So I think that we are all in positions of interaction, and we ourselves have undoubtedly struggled in this room with these clinical entities that are going to be discussed over this conference. So I really invite you to bring in thoughts, experiences, vignettes even, during this of my presentations and other ones that you think bear on the topics. Because we have all encountered this in some way, and we're all both patients and clients and caregivers and teachers and really, taking off from the Parsha, listeners and healers. We're both, we're the caregiver and we're the clients kind of simultaneously. So as Rabbi Kelman said, I'm coming from a professional position of both being a psychiatrist, so I have had an active private practice for like really a long time at this point, and also in the position of training for like about over 10 years now, young rabbinical students, some of whom are hopefully are Mismachim in your are in your communities. And so a lot of my thinking is how do you prepare people, and I want us to reflect on this, to hear the difficult material that gets presented in these clinical situations. So like even some of the discussion before, let's say the example of the angioplasty, I want us to be really thinking about, what in my field is called the countertransference. What are the feelings and the thoughts and the issues that get activated in the mind and in the heart of the listener? So what's going on? I mean, we could talk about this, the Parsha would be very interesting. But in terms of, let's say, just using the example of the angioplasty, what's going on in the doctor or the nurse's mind when he or she is explaining the procedure to the patient? What is she or he allowing themselves to hear or to not hear? How do we invite people to share difficult information, to provide an active, compassionate, non-judgmental listening space for difficult material, all of which impacts and will then, have a continuous impact on insight and judgment and decision making? And how do we close off people from, divulging or sharing or asking? So we have, we all know that you can consciously and mostly unconsciously communicate, oh, don't tell me that. You know, don't ask me that question, or we don't talk about that here, or it's not like, you know, it's not like there's a big sign up, you know, we don't talk about this topic, but we can communicate this in all kinds of ways. So I really want to think about how, especially since, you know, the two or three, depending on how we look at the topics that I'm going to be talking about a bit more, eating disorders, depression, suicidality, maybe childhood abuse, they're not neutral. I mean, those topics evoke really uncomfortable, kinds of reactions from people. And so as I said, it's difficult to to provide a listening space, which can then allow, if that space is provided and there's a safe holding environment in which to explore these clinical situations, then something can happen. I'm not going to really be in the area of Shote too much. I think it's incredibly important bedrock, but I'm really not going to talk so much in the realm of the very obviously disturbed mental condition. You know, the psychotic person, you know, the definition of which where there is really a break from reality. The psychotic person cannot discriminate from what we would agree on as what's going on in reality, and they have a different internal reality going on. So I'm actually not going to be talking about that so much. And of course, that can exist. Certainly in depression, there is a whole area of psychotic depression where people can have all kinds of delusions about their badness or about things happening to them. But I'm really going to stay more in the realm of what I think we encounter probably on an everyday basis, where people's lives are punctuated by experiences with eating disorders, depression, and perhaps abuse, past histories of abuse. And so not so much in the very disturbed, severe mental illness, although I am happy, if people want to bring that up, I'm not happy, but I am available to talk about those entities as well, which I deal with quite a bit. It's another point that Dr. Weiss brought up, and I think it's so important to underscore, and that is the need to be humble in being practitioners of whatever we're practicing, because if you're a principal of a school, you are a mental health practitioner in some way. And I think that while, of course, we go into prescribing and delivering treatment, in good faith, using studies and methodologies and wisdom that we believe, I think we still have to say, how do we convey? Well, we can't be entirely sure, but we also don't want to undermine the patient's confidence in a treatment. And I think it is an important balance to be mindful of. And I do think, it's such an important concept that you were talking about, Dr. Weiss, in terms of the fact that a person halakhically, do they have the right to refuse treatment, is not the same as coerce. Does not necessarily lead to, well, do we have to coerce, or can we not coerce, or whatever. I think that maintaining humility about what we know about medical science at any point in time does not have to lead to either being, well, this is the only way, and if you don't do this, I'm dropping you from treatment, although I have to say there are many situations where that might be appropriate. But I think it's also like, we're doing the best we can. We're going to work on this together. I'm going to continue to listen to you, and I'm going to continue to be tuned into what's going on. So I think that whole notion of a kind of humbleness in our role as treatment providers is really important. So to talk in terms of some of these clinical areas, in terms of eating disorders, and I did include an article in the binder by my colleague and friend Esther Altman, who's done a lot of speaking. Actually, she's from Montreal, come to think of the Canadian connection here. And I think it's very it's framed in terms of eating disorders in the Jewish community. And again, I really invite people to make comments or ask questions during my part of the conversation with you. Certainly in terms of, I think there's nobody, I'm sure of this, that there's nobody in the mental health business, and I bet in the education business as well, who has not been really exposed to certainly bulimia, which is the less medically dangerous form of major eating disorders, and really seems to be wildly rampant at this point in time. Just in terms of definitions, anorexia nervosa is really described, defined as a very pernicious sense of intense fixation on whittling away body fat. It's predominantly found in women. There is a very small rate in men. And these, I'm just going to say women, since that is by far the predominant group, are really committed to starving themselves to ever-increasing points of thinness. And I have to emphasize, which I'm sure most people in this room know, that there is a very significant, not just morbidity in terms of, you know, I don't know, bone wasting or whatever aspects of this, but as mortality. There really is a death rate of probably 10 to 15% of these women who die quite young from, terrible electrolyte imbalances, from all kinds of aspects, medical aspects of anorexia. So it is not just an unpleasant illness, it is really a quite dangerous one. And bulimia, which is far more rampant, is characterized more by binging and purging, meaning like excessive overeating followed by either self-induced vomiting or laxative abuse, or periods of binging and sort of fasting. And that is actually quite inefficient in terms of reducing body weight. Those women are not necessarily so thin. But what they describe is a kind of, I'm sure Dr. Rabbi Weiner is going to talk about this in terms of addictions. There's a kind of compelling urgency to participate in the behavior. And while it originates in a food and body image kind of setting, the experience of bulimia has a kind of tension-relieving quality to it. If you get to know, I'm sure there are people in this room who have done this, if you get to hear a young woman or a woman speak about a bulimic episode, she will talk about that she knows she's going to do it, that certain events are triggering this off, that she will either go out and buy the food for it or will eat everything in the house. And there's a kind of an arc which they will describe feeling a tremendous amount of self-disgust, but there is almost an unstoppable arc from the beginning of the binge to the purge, let's say to the vomiting episode. And they will describe, sometimes with tremendous amount of disgust or whatever, but still that there is a kind of tremendous relief, a sense of cleanness, a sense of separation from the world and from the whatever is the problems or the experiences of that day, of that period of time. There is a sense of relief, and it is incredibly difficult to interrupt that kind of behavior. Now, how prevalent is this in the Jewish community? It's very hard to know any of these things from a statistical point of view because, you know, who goes out and does some kind of large, well-controlled study of, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 or whatever, you know, Jewish high school students compared to the control group, et cetera, et cetera. It certainly seems to be quite prominent in our community. I also think that this, along with many other clinical syndromes that we see, we as a community go to treatment much more than other communities do. So you can't go by how many girls are in, eating disorder treatment programs, and certainly a larger number than the population would be, are going to be coming from Jewish and observant homes. That in itself is no indication of greater prevalence in the population. You see what I mean? Because we are a high treatment-seeking community. It's like Lahavdil with autism and spectrum disorders. I don't think there's any evidence that there's more prevalence in the Orthodox community, but we are a community that seeks treatment in a more intensive kind of a way. But getting to, this is sort of a framing of our larger issue of the impact of eating disorders on insight and judgment, and I think it is very impressive. And again, you know, who doesn't know somebody with an eating disorder? You know, I mean, or doesn't know of somebody with an eating disorder? I think it would be very few people who would raise their hands. And these young women, I'm going to say young women, there's also older women, and there's an increasing awareness of eating disorders in the older population. These people are highly productive in many ways. I mean, they are, you know, we all know, very goal-oriented, high achievers, the very good girls. You know, there's all sorts of discussion about how much are they responding to the pressures to be superstars academically, you know, the whole shidduch emphasis on, you know, is the girl a size 4 and what is her mother's size and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of these girls can be incredibly high achievers, and it's not like they're not going to be running around ripping their clothes in graveyards, you know, or running out at night or something. But they are doing very intense activities certainly the anorectics, to maintain a way less than healthy. Most of these girls, you know, are radically underweight, no longer have their periods, are losing body hair, you know, are really in a metabolically quite depressed state, and they are doing very bizarre things to maintain that, and they are almost maniacally, and I use that word with some degree of, you know, with thoughtfulness, they are devoted to maintaining their behaviors, and they will do almost anything to protect their anorexia. So that if they are in treatment programs, these treatment programs, let's say inpatient treatment programs, are very aware of this, you know, and these kids have to get weighed like in hospital gowns because they'll put pennies in their pockets, or they're not allowed to drink before their weigh-ins because they will try to, you know, drink a lot of fluid so their weight looks good for the doctor, but they, you know, they really haven't gained weight, or they will exercise obsessively in the middle of the night. There is an incredible, and here I would say this does border on the Shotek kind of behavior. You won't see it all of the time because they might be getting A pluses, you know, in physics, but they're really, their insight and judgment is severely impaired by this, and I would say near delusional or delusional, and I'm using delusion in the clinical meaning of a fixed false belief. They believe that they must be thin, and that is the way that they feel control and power in their lives. Now, how they got there is like a whole study in itself, and I alluded to some of these things from before, not, you know, like societal pressure, the emphasis in fashion and whatever to be thin. I don't want to skim over that because that's just too shallow for such an important topic, but there is no question in my mind that there is a real impact on these women's capacity for insight and judgment, and that very much needs to be taken into account in making that connection from a treating point of view. And all of us, you know, whether we're physicians, healthcare professionals, educators, Jewish leaders, are gatekeepers in that treatment experience. And I think, and this kind of comes back to what I was saying earlier about the countertransference aspects of this, it's very hard, you know, to say to, a young woman, you know, Chani, you're looking kind of, you know, peaked, or I'm worried about your weight, or you know, or whatever it is. A lot of times this comes about in a third-person point of view. I remember one of my students was a cook in the kitchen of B'nai Akiva camp, and he said that he started to really pay attention to the amount of requests for vegetarian meals coming from girls. It's not like every vegetarian girl is an anorectic, but it's a warning sign. And it's like, and a lot of times educators and rabbis get the question like, Rabbi, what should we do? We're worried about Leah. You know, we're worried that she, like, what, and so what does that educator do? How do you make that approach? How do you get the parents involved in order to, because the capacity of the person themselves to see that there's a problem is severely compromised. And there was a very painful article in the New York Times Magazine some years ago, which alerted me, I didn't even know about this, to that, and now with the era of the internet, there's all of these, that they call pro-Anna, meaning pro-anorectic websites, which give girls tips on how to maintain their anorexia. And they see this as a kind of political statement, you know, that you have the right, again, what do you have the right, I'm pointing to Dr. Weiss because we have now, you know, dubbed him as a person who's, has talked all about the capacity. What was that acronym now? The decision-making capacity. You know, does a 21-year-old, 85-pound young woman have the decision-making capacity to go onto websites and to, find new ways to support or to even find support for her anorexia? So I think that this is something that is of great concern to our community. Like I said, in terms of morbidity and mortality, is not insignificant in its own. While bulimia is less threatening, certainly from a mortality point of view, and it does have its morbidity, I mean, in terms of, you know, esophageal erosion or teeth erosion or whatever, it's less of a scary medical impact. But in terms of the secretive corrosive behavior, I think it's quite a large burden. And I think that the numbers of women, particularly men as well, though I certainly have heard of men who engage in bulimic behavior, is really quite astounding. And it's very hard. While I don't think the intensity and the, you know, a 89-pound or 79-pound anorexic young woman will say, you know, I think I look great, and will even try to lose more weight. I mean, there is a ferocity of that mental state, which you don't see as much at all in the bulimics. But it is an extremely difficult disorder or a behavior to try to break. And people do revert to it, like I was saying earlier, with the discharge of tension and the sense, even as they feel sick with their own behavior, as they're, you know, stuffing away all of these, and they don't necessarily go out and buy or prepare fine food to binge on, which they're then going to throw up. They will really eat anything that's around, you know, old spaghetti, pizza from the garbage, you know, the remnants from meals 4 days ago. It's really anything. There is a kind of a self-loathing aspect that comes in, but it's very hard to interpret. And I've seen patients of mine, some of whom I've had in treatment, I'm thinking of one woman for about 20 years now, who actually was in an inpatient treatment program as a teenager for anorexia, you know, finished a top-tier graduate program, stellar career, et cetera, but in times of great distress will find that she reverts to bulimic episodes. And she, it's not like she feels better for it, but it's a kind of an anxiety and tension discharge. And I think it's so important for us to maintain an awareness about this and to ask. You know, there's actually, I just skimmed that very briefly, obviously, just the handout, which is, who is the person from Israel, the English one? Anyway, it talks about, like, it's a Q&A, like how to ask questions. They use the angioplasty example. You know, are you aware of, you know, have you thought about, I mean, all of that kind of, those little talking tips and question prompts, I think could be used in any of these disorders. I'm going to go over, I mean, I started late, so I'll go to the depression and suicidality in a moment, but I just want to ask for any thoughts, comments about, yes, please.
So, I'm a palliative care physician.
Palliative care, yeah, huh?
I actually had a case of a young woman who had been through various treatments for anorexia, went for a diet service at a home-based service for support at home. She did not want to die, but she did not want to eat.
Right.
She would pull out the feeding tube and have them in, and eventually they said, there's nothing more we can offer her. The thing is going to take, and she was sort of like a cliffhanger, holding on by her fingernails, not dying, but living. And the service struggled with it because it was actually her illness that was taking away her capacity.
Right.
So you say no, you force treatment because they don't have the capacity, or you say no, she has the capacity and we can't intervene. I mean, I think the psychiatrist struggled with it and they had worked with her for many years, and then they gave her to us.
Can you just say a few words? Did everybody hear about this young woman who was in a palliative care program for, sounds like almost end-stage anorexia? What was the reaction of your team to treating this kind of woman?
We had rounds around that. I mean, we were all, there were people on both sides.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was gut-wrenching, basically.
Yeah, what a talk about puns. Yeah, that's for sure. I bet it was.
I didn't mean
that. Yeah, right. Well, you know, the unconscious speaks. You know, that's a heartbreaking case.
That's capacity and consent.
That's right.
I mean, does she or doesn't she, or, you have rational suicide.
Right. You see, I think that, you know, this kind of comes to what do we as a culture, as a Western culture and as observant Jewish culture, determine is reasonable. And I don't think that we determine, like while we might say that not electing to go on a respirator when you have end-stage ALS might seem reasonable, that I think very few people would agree that it would be reasonable for a young person to decide that she wants to starve to death. Right. Right.
You were inducing this horrible state for her. So.
Right. I mean, I think that I would feel that most people, I think I would be in the majority here, would say that while she was being tortured, anorexia in itself is not an end-stage medical illness that somebody has the right to refuse treatment on. You know, like I might feel differently, or certainly people would feel differently about electing to refuse dialysis at end-stage kidney disease, or not going for some new wave, you know, anti-cancer treatment. I think very few people would say this is end-stage anorexia and we're not going to treat her. You know, also I think that there's something about people...
What happened?
And did she die?
She did.
Yeah, yeah. So they let her be.
I don't think. I think her body let her. Her body failed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there does come that point. You know, how old was she?
30.
So she presented for treatment. Like how? Why did she? No, but you know, there's something about, again, I'm very interested in the interaction between the client and the caregiver, because there is something about this person presenting for treatment. You know, she could have not let the palliative care people through the door. She could have refused to speak to them. Like, if she was engaged in any capacity, if she spoke to them, if she gave a history, I would say that she was indicating a certain amount of ambivalence about wanting to be treated. Because you do speak with your feet to a certain degree. Now, she might not have been able to walk on her feet at that point, but she did. I don't know if this treatment was entirely forced upon her, or she was she completely...
We weren't there to competing to.
Right.
We were there to ensure her comfort.
Uh-huh. I see. Well, this is, you know, I think we can continue with this, but maybe it's sort of a bit on the extremes. I'd love to hear about this some more, you know, talk about this more. Other thoughts about eating disorders, please. No, I really was just going to touch on it. I think compulsive overeating, I think it's an important area clinically. I don't think it has the bearing. Well, it does have, in the sense of an addiction, maybe we would lump this with addictions, where people who are compulsively overeating know that this is not a healthy thing for themselves. They know that it is making them unhappy in terms of body experience and whatever, but cannot seem to stop themselves. So where is the insight? Where is the capacity to harness that insight and to get treatment or to stop? I think that it is in the addiction realm, which maybe I'll leave to Rabbi Weinreb, since I do want to get to depression a little bit. Yes. I can't say it's not an issue. I'm not aware of any systematic looking at a large number of women with anorexia and whether or not there's been higher rates of sexual abuse among them than a control. Certainly, I mean, I know from my own study that when we looked at a group of almost 400 women who presented for, who filled out questionnaires having to do with sexual life, a fourth, 20 to 25% of them did present with histories of some degree of sexual molestation or abuse. So I think that a large number of these women were, they were currently religious women. A large number of them, about 36% of that group, were from Baal's Tshuva. They were not from religious backgrounds. The rate was lower, but not amazingly lower. It was like a little under 20%. It was 20% of the 19% of women from birth homes and 36% of women from who were Baal's Tshuvas. So whether it's 19 is still a fifth. So it was impressed. That's not necessarily correlated, though, with eating disorders. This was actually not correlated with anything. This was women who were willing to fill out a survey about their sexual life as married, observant women. So I think that the rates of sexual abuse in the Orthodox community are significant. How much that's correlated with eating disorders, I don't think anybody really knows. Yes?
I saw this year, I don't know if you've seen it, a young girl, late 20s, who's that's an exercise.
Right.
She's very muscular. She looks terrific, but she's obsessed with any body fat.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll work out 4 or 5 hours a day. She's going into a treatment program.
Well, I think that's an exercise addiction. You know, I wouldn't say it's necessarily anorexia, because if she's not, you know, anorexia has certain criteria. It's like less, having lost like 20% of your normative body weight. So maybe she isn't, right, you know, wildly thin and scary looking, but she is compulsively addicted to exercise.
No, I'm not saying anorexia is dysmorphic.
She could be. Body dysmorphic disorder is when people have a sense that there's something wrong with a part of their body, like their nose is horrible or their skin is disgusting. You know, and there's a delusion. The definition of a delusion psychiatrically is a fixed false belief. So, if a person does have people who have body dysmorphic disorder (BDD) don't have bizarre body parts. Whether or not this woman thought that her thighs were horrible or something, I don't know. But you really see a lot of exercise addiction. And I think that, the nature, the definition of this kind of thing is an activity that it has a shape to it or amount of time devoted that then impacts on normative functioning. So if somebody, when do we call it an addiction? When do we say that somebody has an alcohol addiction? Well, I'm going to leave this to Rabbi Dr. Weinreb. But certainly when it impacts on what we consider to be normative life in terms of functioning, in terms of time allotment, well, that time is, part of functioning. But if somebody's exercising 4 to 5 hours a day and they're not preparing for the Olympics, I would say that is an exercise addiction, which might have elements of a body dysmorphic or other body distortion going on, but I wouldn't know that until I, really spent time with them and took a history.
Definitely she feels she's overweight. It's a delusion.
Yeah, that is kind of it is a fixed false belief. And like I started off saying, these are people who can be, I'm sure she's very functional in other ways, who are, like, it's when you get into this vein. 5 minutes. All right. I'm just going to go to depression and suicidality, because this is something that I feel very strongly about. And we all know in this room the impact of depression and the threat of suicide is one that is, so tragic. And the key thing that I want to talk about, now I mentioned earlier that certainly you can have psychotic depression where somebody has a delusion, that they are, that their body smells or that they have caused horrible harm in the world. And you can't convince somebody out of a delusion. You can't present evidence or whatever. And I'm not talking about that so much at this point. I'm talking about depression as we know it, in which people are sad, they're hopeless, they're crying, they feel that their life is worthless, they feel something, if it thickens and they lean towards suicidality, they feel that their loved ones would be better off without them, that their world is, is such a terrible place that they no longer feel like going on. And the key thing that I really want to convey here in terms of our theme, which is insight and judgment, is depression as a clinical entity really distorts the apparatus of perception. That people who are depressed and who might be, their functionality certainly dwindles as the illness thickens, but they cannot see. And those of us who have been there know this, and we all know people who've been there. They cannot remember. They can't remember the feeling of that they were once different. It's like really the tunnel closes in, and they just can't feel that there's any light anyplace else. And that it's just never going to get better. And that said, and that I think is where the caregiver can be so incredibly important to actually, and I've said these words so many times, I know you can't remember now that you were ever different, but you're 38 years old and you have 36 years of excellent functioning, and I believe, and I will tell you this, and you can call me and I'll remind you whenever you want, that you will be that person again. Because the impact on insight and judgment is profound in depression, and it can lead people, as that sense of badness and of guilt and wrongdoing and worthlessness is a key word, thickens, the capacity to remember who they were and what they might be again is diminished, and the thought of like the out towards suicidality can become stronger and stronger. I was going to talk a little bit about because an area that I'm interested in is reproductive psychiatry, of like depression during pregnancy and postpartum. And apropos of some of the questions in the earlier talk about medication and how we, you know, like I was saying before about therapeutic humility, you know, there's a lot of issues having to do, you know, there's sort of more data coming out about concerns about use of antidepressants during pregnancy. And there's a report that is there a link to autism? Now, the report itself is quite flawed, but of course, you know, those of us who do prescribe are always concerned about the impact of any kind of exogenous medication or whatever on a developing baby, and, you know, the cost-benefit of if a woman is really depressed during her pregnancy, and there's all kinds of implications of that, what are you going to do? So the whole insight and judgment thing on both sides, is the woman going to take medication? Is she then going to feel guilty? How do you make that decision? I think, you know, whoever brought that question up earlier, it's a very profound one. But the key thing I want to just leave this, because I only have like a minute, about depression is the tremendous impact and diminution of the sense of worth and the sense of potential, and how that light just gets closed down and people really feel darkness. And why we really need to be mindful of that in the treatment and the awareness, and asking people, you know, like, have you, I tell this to my students all the time, because we all see clinical depression around us, you know, to just ask the question. When we ask a question, you never put ideas in people's heads when you ask a question. When you say, have you ever felt so bad that you've thought of ending your life, you don't give anybody an idea to commit suicide. That idea is like there, and people will think of it themselves. What you do is you give them permission to talk about it, and you, by saying those words, you indicate that you've heard this before, that this has happened in the human condition, that this person is not some freak of nature who's the first, like, pervert who's thought of ending their life, which certainly as a religious person they feel, you know, even more complicated about. When you ask that as a teacher, as a healthcare professional, as a whatever, community person, you're saying, I've heard this before, and you can talk to me about it, and we'll look at this together. I'm on your team. So I'm going to close with that. I don't know, should I just wait for questions till later? Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much.